The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
President Michael D. Higgins, thank you very much for joining us on The Last Word. It has been a while. I think the last time you were on the programme, I went up to the Oris and conducted an interview with you and Sabina one Christmas, I think 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah. But we're back now in an election campaign and you're looking to get the job again. I suppose the first thing I want to ask you is, did you watch last night's television debate on Clareburn Live?
Well, I've looked at some of the playback on it, but I was in fact reading the health and alcohol bill. It's 31 sections, and that's the bill that's currently on my desk. It has to be dealt with by Friday. It came last Friday, so I had 7 days to deal with it.
Okay. How often, I mean, is that a large part of the work that you do, that any president will have to do? Do you have to read every line of legislation that has been passed by the Oireachtas?
Well, it's one of the advantages that I have. If you have been in cabinet, as I had, the two cabinets, and if you've been in the Dáil, you're able to go, if you like, to the nub of the debate rather quickly. But usually what you get is the text of the bill, the Dáil debates, the Senate debates, any representations that have been received, and the media comments on it. And you go through that. And obviously what you're looking for, the test is not as to whether it's good or bad legislation. The test is as to whether there's a constitutional contravention or something upon which you might have a question.
Not your own personal opinion on it.
You can never really do that because that isn't what you're there for. What is interesting is that the time is tight. In other words, that you get the bill, let's say that I got it last Friday evening. If you were to hold a Council of State, you'd have to give notice to the members of the Council of State, who are all former Taoiseach, former Chief Justices, and you have seven that you would have nominated yourself. But they would have to come, and it isn't they who decide. The decision then is your own. So in a way, you have quite a tight period. That where it's really testing is towards Christmas, where many times during those times you were interviewing me, you could get, because of a rush of bills that finish in the Dáil or on fifth stage, you could have up to 14 or 15 together.
How many times have you called the Council of State during your presidency?
Twice. Yeah.
Only twice?
Yes.
And what particular pieces of legislation were they, and why did you call the Council of State?
Well, those legislation were in relation to, I felt that there had been a public a public interest in the interpretation of them, particularly in relation to, let us say, if you're dealing with legislation like abortion legislation or legislation like that. And I think that there it is appropriate to allow for a discussion. It's interesting the way it happens. It's usually led off by the Attorney General, who makes the case and reminds whoever's the president of the day that legislation is prepared on the presumption of constitutionality. But you, that is I, in those two occasions that read out what I felt was my reason for saying this is something upon which I want to have certainty. And then they go away, and usually in the following 24 hours for consideration, you make your mind up as to whether to refer or whether you're going to sign. The difficulty about referring, and it's an interesting one, is that if you refer and the Supreme Court decide that the bill is constitutional, you have then closed it off for a citizen to ever take a case. So what you have also to ask yourself, therefore, I don't want to make it sound too complicated.
No, but this is the job, and I think people perhaps at times don't know what the job is.
Yes, and therefore what you have to decide, therefore, would it be better tested by case law? And the one thing about that is that the citizen will have particular fact to, in fact, base a case. And it is actually one of the issues in relation to the court. The court on balance, when you look across all referrals, tends to be in favour of the case law. So that's an issue.
Do you think your competitors in this election race have the necessary experience from their careers to be able to do that job?
Well, I think that I have an advantage of having, if you like, been involved in drafting legislation, as I was when I was minister between 93 and 97, and also in two different cabinets. But I wouldn't run them down at all. I'm sure that they would acquire it. But one of the things you must also say is that in relation to the Council of State, for example, it is not a council of advisers. It is a council of people who have held eminent positions, a council of former Taoiseach, former Chief Justices, And then you have the current Taoiseach, you have the current Attorney General, and you have the seven that are nominated by the Taoiseach in office.
So do you think some of the other candidates fail to understand the role of the Council of State?
I think sometimes they confuse the distinction between the Council of State as it's expressed in the Constitution and a Council of Advisors. That is why, for example, there is a great advantage in having the one advisor that I have. Each president has had an advisor, and that advisor acts as a liaison between you and the formal opinion, let us say, attached to the office of the presidency and the department. But actually, to be honest, well, you know, I was a political scientist as well, and I used to give lectures on these matters about the legislative process. And it is very interesting because I think when you look back at how your predecessors have handled it as well, there have been occasions, for example, another one is that you might think that a particular section raises a constitutional issue, but the Supreme Court may decide that they're going to judge the whole bill, not the section that you're referring. And in that case, you could, in fact, actually be back to starting point again.
Okay, so you only were looking up and down at the television last night. So did anything?
No, I was looking at it afterwards. I did.
Afterwards. Did any of it annoy you afterwards? I mean, one of your advisors clearly got in touch in relation to the question of who pays for the grooming of your dogs. Did you get annoyed by anything that you saw?
In fairness now, it was somebody from the campaign that got on. Because, yes. And what they pointed out is that I take responsibility. I pay for my dog's food, my dog's vets, and my dog's and grooming. And the dogs, by the way, are very popular. In fact, there was a group in today, one of the many groups that come in. There was a group in today to watch the credential ceremony from Loughrea ICA. And as I had all said goodbye to them, they said, but we haven't seen the dogs yet.
You're indeed using those dogs like a weapon, aren't you?
No, I think that they're a breed that likes, they're a very sociable breed, and they're very safe children for that. And I think I've always had dogs all my life, but I've had actually three, because one of the original ones died, and the second dog that I took on was a dog that had difficulties, and they're both beautiful dogs now.
When you say difficulties, what's
well, health it was in, yeah.
The style in which you now live is a million miles away from what you grew up in.
Yes, indeed it is. Yeah.
Because you grew up, I think, in quite abject poverty.
Well, I was born into quite some security when I was born in Limerick City. And my father had about 8 good years after he came out of the internment camp. No one would give. He had started off from he was the youngest in a family of 10, and he had been an apprentice to Barron Grocery, and he'd worked in Barron Grocery in Innes and Limerick and in Charleville. And during the War of Independence, he and his brothers were involved in that. But then in the Civil War came, my father went on the anti-treaty side. My uncles were on the treaty side. And my father, when he came out in 1924, couldn't get a job anywhere. So he had, during the War of Independence, a salary of £330 a year and £50 travelling expenses. But he wouldn't get all the local trades asked for him to get his job back after coming out of Tin Town. But employer refused. So then he just went to work for Nolan's in Newbridge for £50 a year, and he's indoor, and he started all over again. And then he rented a premises in Limerick as a bar, and he did very well. And everything was fine until his health broke in 1946. And then things began to go downhill. And my mother and it was the person I think who suffered most. My mother and my twin sisters lived at 10 different addresses, moving from one flat to another in Limerick City. My brother and myself, I was 5, my brothers 4, we were reared by a very loving uncle and aunt in County Clare. And that was fine too, until my uncle was 60 when I went to live with him at 5 years of age. And everything was fine when the tasks around the small farm could be done. But then when it was one room slated, 2 rooms attached, so then when you suddenly see the house going into disrepair, and it begins to get difficult. So, but Quite frankly, I had a good experience, but I would say that education was what was important. We were 8.5 miles from secondary school, my brother and I, and we took advantage of that, and it served us well.
But the conditions you live in now is opulence by comparison. How's the last 7 years been like? What has it done to change you as a person, living in the circumstances in which you do, with a very high income that you get, and with the responsibilities that you have? How has it changed you as a person?
I don't think it has changed me very much, because I'll tell you why. We live in a wing of the house, and the major rooms of the house, you've been up there, they're used for ceremonial purposes. And really, the interesting thing about the house is about 20,000 people a year go through it. But it's interesting that it's 80 years since Douglas De Heda moved in there. The house wasn't in very good condition then. And in the 1990s, a considerable amount of money was spent on doing up the house. And that's the origin of, up to that time when Mary Robinson came in then, she began garden parties again. She had very limited sum. And then in 1998, there was a business plan submitted, and it suggested that the house having been renovated, the gardens having been developed, and it is in that case President McAleese expanded very much the number of people who were visiting, so that it went from hundreds to thousands. And it is today about 20,000 come through the formal rooms. You would have people from garden parties, you have people from citizens' tea parties, you have ceremonials, you have special events for sports things, you have people like, for example, the Paralympics, the Special Olympics, all of this that goes on. So you asked me, has it changed? To be frank with you, it's a privilege to be in the position I'm in, but I haven't had much time to think about it. I enjoy it. It's a very fine staff.
But what about the perception that has been created by some of your opponents, that you've become effectively a very wealthy man in the position? €250,000 salary in the job, you have a pension from NUIG. Presumably, you have an awful lot of your living expenses covered as well in the house. You're not nipping off down to Dunstores or the local supermarket every weekend yourself, are you, filling up the shelves?
I think what's important about it is that, first of all, in relation to the salary, I'm happy to take whatever salary that the government of the day decides. That's fine with me. I'm not in it to make money. Indeed, that is one of the reasons, for example, and because as I began, I realised we were in great difficulty, sacrifices were responsible. Remember, people were taking a reduction in income of between 15 and 20%. You know, this figure's as good as I. And the point is, I offered the reduction in salary. What I have to do every year is that I sign that every year, and I have signed it as well right up to November. I don't draw my double pension, I don't draw my Senate pension, and the pension that you're referring to of about 19,000 a year is one that was there securing the mortgage in my house in Galway. And it was when I left university, it was a contributory pension. It is one into which I had been paying, and it was one which, for example, the bank would have required of me at that time. And actually, to be frank with you, I have a number of commitments that I make to different organisations. That's where that. And
well, that brings you a nice
question.
And we are,
by the way, as well, always, since, and we're very happy to do it. Both Sabina and I have, for a very long time, since we got married, we have been. Remember, Sabina gave up her job because of the marriage bar. We have been a single income household, and we're very happy. And yes, I repeat again, whatever salary government of the day decides, I'm happy to accept.
And this is a personal question, Zumda, but it's the nature of the public office you run for. What do you spend your money on?
Well, on different things. I think as well, in relation to the maintenance of my house in Galway, which takes a great deal of time, that's fine. But basically, I have other interests as well in relation to, I have savings, I decided, and so it'll save you time. Sabina and I lived for 11 years in Fairlands Park. It may well be the place where we go back to, who knows. I bought a family home there. And in the future, that is what it is for. It's for family. And I service that out of a mortgage.
So you're presuming that you will serve a full 7-year term if you're re-elected and then go to retirement finally, because the last time...
Well, I don't think the Constitution would suggest that I can do anything else.
Well, that brings me on to some other things. If you could have Ireland being like any other country in the world, what country would you like to see Ireland be most like?
Oh, I think it's very difficult because there have been countries where I saw great prospects and where they have in fact actually been very good for a while. And then they have gone into reverse. I suppose if the countries with which whose social structure that I would know as well as their economy, it would probably rather like the Scandinavian countries. But I would very much like that to be softened, as it were, with the cultural experience of the great heritage we have in really. There's a great friendliness in Ireland. There are sets of intimacies associated with rural and urban life and in the villages. And there are there's a great texture in Irish society. Over the last 7 years, Sabina and I have been in villages and cities and towns. Remember, after 2011, you were going into a context of people with very many broken expectations, disappointments, for example, by people who'd invested in their children's education, expecting that they would have very secure professional incomes, and suddenly all of this seems turned upside down. One thing that has really struck me about this campaign is, they would say in Irish, I'm doing two things. I'm incumbent president, and yet I'm a candidate, which puts constraints on me. But I have thousands of people who are in fact running the Michael D campaign. And among the brightest are really creative young people. Maybe the biggest meeting I had here, wonderful meeting I had here, was Youth for Michael D. And why I mention that in the context of what people were through after 2011. Young people in Ireland have not chosen cynicism. They have chosen involvement and they are actually making the change. It isn't a case of they coming into my campaign. It is in fact of they shaping my campaign. They're doing things that I wouldn't have in fact been able to do or dream of in relation to communicating political ideas.
In your 7 years as president, how many missteps did you take? How many things do you look back upon and regret?
Well, I don't believe in lashing yourself with regret. I'm sure I have made mistakes, some of them. Sometimes, for example, in my impatience to respond to events, I wasn't cautious enough for the people who would like me to be extremely cautious. But the kind of person I am is that I am a passionate person who believes in things and who believes in values. And you know what I'm bringing to this now is people would say, we've already said the experience I've had in the Dáil, the experience I've had as a minister, the experience I've had as president of the Council of Culture Ministers. You correctly asked me about my early life. It is one's life's values. It is the experience of life you bring to the presidency. And I knew when I came that I would be putting a particular kind of brand on it. And therefore, what did I do? I said, it will be a presidency of ideas. And I'm very glad I did that because that's what I can do. If when I go on trips or anything, I give lectures or I give papers, like I gave one on the anniversary of the civil rights movement in Derry two Saturdays ago. That's my contribution. That's my giving back, if you like.
The reason I bring it up is I looked back today on the statement that you issued on the death of Fidel Castro, and it sort of shocked me at the time, and it shocks me again today to read it.
All right.
Because that's something that I would put to you was misjudged, because this man was a dictator who held on to power for decades upon decades, who was ruthless in the suppression of his own people, particularly people from the LGBT community. Thousands went to their deaths trying to escape by fleeing the island. Do you not perhaps sometimes have a rather romanticised view of some of your political heroes from previous decades?
Well, I'll tell you, I think you put it very fairly to me, except that I don't, you'll appreciate, I don't agree with that summary of President Castro's life. I think all there were faults there, and all of what you mentioned by the LGBTI community and all of that. When I visited at the request of the Irish government, they wanted me to visit Colombia. I visited Peru, Colombia and Cuba, and I sat down with 14 organisations that are critical of President Castro and his regime. And Raúl Castro was president then, and I dealt with for a couple of hours with those 14, and I raised those issues. But I don't avoid your question about it. I'll tell you why. When I was, is my view romanticised? I'll tell you what my view was. My view one was of a great hope. I was reading around the time of that I issued that statement, and I think I was correct to issue a statement on the death of somebody who had led, defeated a dictatorship indeed, and established things, but made many mistakes, I agree. But what I want should, what I was thinking of very much, I was thinking of the period of Nyerere. I was thinking of the period of Rajiv Gandhi. I'd been reading about the period of Fidel at that time. Remember, president of the Non-Aligned Movement, president of the Group of 77. I was present at the Rio conference when everyone expected him to give a very long couple of hours speech, and he spoke for about 12 minutes. And he said, "La deuda del humanidad." He said, "Let us pay the debt to humanity." The debt to humanity, not the debts to the banking system. And it only lasted 12 minutes. Now, I agree with you. I had an idea. That's where one my idealism lives. And I tell you, and it'll save you coming to it about the other people you're mentioning. Do you think that my heart is not broken about Nicaragua? I was there during just after the Sandinistas overthrew a dictatorship, and now I see that what Ortega and Rosario Murillo are doing, and I think it's outrageous and wrong, and this is something that I have discussed with my friends.
Have you ever changed your view about Ronald Reagan? Because you would have protested when he visited Ireland,
yeah.
And yet history would perhaps say that Ronald Reagan, for all of his many faults, particularly in Central and Latin America, which you love, was a major figure in bringing down the dictatorships of state socialism in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and that overall that he was a force for good. Would you have reassessed your view of Ronald Reagan?
I think let history judge us all, but I think you're rushing your history a little. And but let me put it that there's no doubt whatever. You could point. It depends on how you interpret history. And, you know, isn't it a pity that in this campaign so far, we're not discussing these deep issues about the past? Remember, what my 7 years, it's there now. I'm willing to be judged on it. How did I handle
it? Maybe it's too soon to judge
How did I handle the 2016 commemorations? What did I say in Northern Ireland last Saturday week? What will I say in relation to the new, the old, the War of Independence, the Civil War, about which, you know, and so forth? Can I not be trusted in that? And that's what is important. And I think in your point as well, in relation to the you're quite right to say, is that there are advances in history. Do you not think, for example, that the British welfare state was a great advance? Do you not think that the British National Health Service was one of the great achievements of humanity? And then you may then history reverses itself and so on. But what I do think, remember what I promised in 2011? I said it will be a presidency of ideas. My hope now is in the next 7 years is to take these and lodge them in the experience and institutions of people. I have four pillars to my programme. Equal and together, strong, sustainable communities, shaping history, sharing history, shaping the future, and Ireland's voice matters. And I will, just in the same way as I ran, for example, my consultation with young people, being young and Irish, or the Ethics Initiative, or GLAOC, and I will have three initiatives in this 7 years, and I've announced one of them already, which is about participation and transformation.
One final one. And this is an issue in relation to your age. And I think it is fair enough to bring up your age. And given that, I think a lot of people felt that you would go for a second term. Hopefully you will be fit and healthy if you are re-elected for the full 7 years. And we would sincerely hope that if you are re-elected, that happens. But if you were to encounter ill health, and the stats are probably suggest that you might be more likely than other candidates because of your age to encounter an ill health over the next 7 years, would you consider in occasion of ill health resigning your position to let somebody else, given all of the heavy mental and physical tasks are involved that you've outlined for us?
Well, I've been getting better at it, actually. I'm fitter now than I was 7 years ago. But of course, one can't be just blindly optimistic. I would always put the public interest first. But let me tell you another thing before you. Let's be careful about statistics. In 1982, there were 42 centenarians in Ireland. Last year, because when I was sent, because I write letters to them all, there were 412, and there would be 452 going out to whoever is sending out the messages for the next year. In fact, as you know, the centenarians' bounty and the salaries of the 27 staff in the ORS are 76% of the much discussed expenditure in the ORS, and all that's up on the website.
But just to clarify the point, if you felt you were physically or mentally slowing down and weren't as able as you clearly are now, would you be inclined towards saying in the national interest that you would resign your position in advance of the end of the 7-year term if events led to that?
Oh, I don't think one should be hypothesising. As I've said to you, I would always put the national interest first. But you know, you use two things as well. You say physical health and cognitive health. Mm. Cognitive health is incredibly important. And it is one of the great, I think, insulting fallacies to all the older people of this country to be saying that you should be, look, you can't change your birth certificate, at least legally, and you can't choose the day you were born. But what you can choose, in fact, is how you live your life, and you should live it with generosity and inclusion. And certainly that's what I do. I am actually, isn't it interesting? It is because I'm open to intergenerational influences and responsibilities that I'm getting such support from younger people. I'm getting support from people of all ages, and I welcome that, and may I really always do that. That's what I hope. And it is because I love Ireland and all of its generations that I'm going forward.
President Michael D. Higgins, thank you very much for taking the time to join us here on The Last Word this evening.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.